From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It seems like everybody wants to be a locavore these days. There's no food more local than a basket of veggies from the garden in your own backyard. Nothing more thrifty either if you're keeping an eye on the budget, or more satisfying if you just want to get close to earth, sun, and water. Put it all together and it feels like the country's got garden fever. This hour On Point, we're getting out in the garden with some pros and with you. You can join the conversation. Have you been hit with the urge to garden? How's it going? Are you a rookie, a newbie, a whiz? And what's in your garden? What's your question on gardening? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let us know what your gardening this year. We've got great gardeners with us today. First, from Colchester, Vermont, Charlie Nardozzi is here, garden coach and consultant, author of Vegetable Gardening for Dummies. He hosts the Vermont Garden Journal on Vermont Public Radio. His new book out this season is Northeast Fruit and Vegetable Gardening. Charlie Nardozzi, welcome to the show. Wonderful to have you.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
And with us from the other side of the country, Portland, Oregon, is Karen Wolfgang. She's owner and project coordinator at Independence Gardens. It's a company that helps people build and grow organic, edible gardens at home. She's got a big green thumb. Karen Wolfgang, welcome to the show. Wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Oh, this is it's exciting already. You know, I was out doing my little very modest bit of gardening last weekend. Love to do it on the weekends and get your fingers and thumbs down in that earth and just spend the day doing it. It's hard work sometimes, Karen, but there's a sort of feeling of well-being that just comes over a person, at least me, when I spend a day with, earth and sun and water.
It's the same for me, and a lot of the clients that we have experience the same thing. There's nothing more satisfying than being out in the elements, even if it's rainy and you have to put on your Gore-Tex foul weather gear. There's something really wonderful and, like you said, satisfying about being out there in it and seeing the fruits of your labor growing.
Even if it's rainy, spoken like a true Oregonian.
Absolutely.
Charlie, here's Karen. She is, in a way, this young generation coming up and doing a lot of gardening. What are you seeing, Charlie, about who's gardening who may not have a few years ago? I mean, is it, you know, I've read you saying that it used to be sort of an older generation that was gardening, and now you see a young tribe coming up.
Well, traditionally, Tom, it has been the 50, 60-year-old who's been the vegetable gardeners. And when I do talks around the country, when I've been doing these talks, say, maybe 10 years ago, that's kind of the crowd I would get. But then I've been noticing over the last 5 or so years that there's a whole nother segment coming into these talks. And these are the 20 to 30-year-olds who are looking for some way to get back to the earth and have a way to express their own personal values. And they find that gardening is the perfect medium to do that. It's a good way to grow your own food, save money, grow healthy, safe food. And also, it really taps into their own personal philosophies on life if they have strong values and beliefs about global warming, reducing their carbon footprint. Gardening is a very practical way for them to make a difference in their own life and in their community.
Karen, do you see that? A new generation of gardeners coming in who maybe even whose parents didn't do it that much, but they're doing it now. What do you think is driving that?
I think, like Charlie said, it's a lot about values. It's a sense of uncertainty about the world that we live in with global warming, climate change, global weirding as we're experiencing it, and a sense of empowerment that comes with not just getting your hands in the earth, but having a direct return on that investment, where we don't necessarily see returns on economic investments elsewhere. The return on gardens, you know, is not always certain, but you at least get to spend that time outside and you see the direct connection between what's happening in your external world and your internal world and that yield that you get. So, yeah, it's an empowerment, living values, and a sense of uncertainty that can be calmed by doing that direct investment.
That is interesting. Direct investment. There's no intermediary here. It's sort of you and the seeds and the earth inputs, Mitt Romney might say, but you're straight at it there, and you see what comes out. I mean, I've got a lot of response here from people online, and it's really interesting. We asked folks on Facebook, what are you planting? And Doug says, heirloom tomatoes, sweet yellow peppers, basil, green beans, summer squash, zucchini, and lettuce, some pots in the yard, some in our community garden. There's all kinds of ways of doing it. Here's another listener who says, I already had my first harvest last night, kale. Already been using sage and oregano, I guess from the, this is Jeff's garden for the last month. The tomatoes, eggplants, lettuce, squash, pray the vine borers stay away. Beets, carrots are in. Hope to have a decent harvest. Terry says, anyone that's eaten many homegrown vegetables know the greater taste is right there. But here, Charlie, AC writes, gardening is a total mystery to me. I can't keep houseplants from dying. Charlie, what about it? When people stride out to sort of put a spade in the backyard or a bunch of pots on the balcony for the first time, what do you find, is sort of at the heart of the mystery of it? What makes it tricky for those coming to it as rookies?
Well, I do get that. I do garden coaching, and I get people who have never gardened before or have done very little gardening, and they just are amazed that you can take a seed or take a little plant, and it'll actually can grow, and it just seems like it's so mysterious, and there's so many variables, and how do you know how deep to plant it, when to plant it, where to plant it, all those kinds of things that go with it. And I think a lot of times beginning gardeners sometimes overthink it. We're in an age where everyone wants to have all the information about everything all the time. Mm-hmm. And gardening is as much an art as it is a science. And when you put seeds in the ground, even experienced gardeners, even people like myself, I had mm-hmm. peas rot this spring because I started a little early. I got a little rambunctious with the warm weather.
Right.
So that is part of the whole gardening experience, is to accept that things will work, things won't work, mm-hmm. and that you have to go on faith a little bit and, of course, have a lot of knowledge and have a lot of experience behind you to know when to plant and what to plant. And I think people get into gardening, especially beginning gardeners, wanting to have a formula that's going to be a surefire, sure thing, and it isn't always that way. There's certainly a lot of things, a lot of variables you can remove, but you have to go out there and really try to just dive into the experience and see what happens.
Karen, I was talking with quite a young gardener just in the last day or two, relatively new to it, and asked her, what was surprising about it. And she said, well, just how fast things come up. You know, if you till the ground well, you put the seed in, and then just it's sort of like magic. You put the seed in and boom, here come the plants. And just the speed of it for somebody who hadn't done a lot of gardening before, you know, the way nature works was sort of magical looking. But I wonder what you find, Karen, in terms of for new gardeners, what is instinctive? What just comes kind of naturally in this relationship with the soil and sun and water and the plants? And what's not? What has to be learned?
Well, we work with a lot of very young gardeners, so school-age gardeners that are just learning about plants for the first time, about the plant life cycle, about how a seed develops into a mature plant and then becomes another seed. And all of that seems to resonate immediately with them. And what I think is harder is for people who are my age, I'm almost 29, getting mm-hmm. up there in years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Graybeard.
Yeah. Yep. And it's a little harder for those of us who are maybe accustomed to instant technologies now with smartphones and information access just all the time, information overload all the time. The instinctual bit of it doesn't seem to work the same way. The way that we process information.
Where do the gaps show up when it's just a rake and a hoe and dirt and seeds?
Well, there's just you can almost see the little question mark hovering over some people's heads. It's like is this really going to happen? So it doesn't happen immediately. You don't put the seed in the ground and voila, there's a start. But it does happen over the course of sometimes only a day or two, but up to a week or two. Mm-hmm. And there's something that happens when people are checking on that seed. It gets really it's kind of obsessive the first few days. Oh my God, is it up? Oh, is it up?
Right.
And then it's there it is. Oh, now what? So there's a different sense of time that comes over gardeners that changes once we've been acculturated to the instant information.
It seems like everybody's doing it these days. We've got the First Lady, Michelle Obama, famously with her kitchen garden she's been writing and talking a lot about lately. She talked with NPR's Renee Montaigne about what it gives back, the peace and beauty of that backyard kitchen garden. In her case, that just happens to be on the south lawn of the White House.
It is beautiful. Here we are in the heart of Washington, D.C. We're looking at the Washington Monument, all that commotion out there. And that's the beauty of gardens. Instantly you have an oasis.
instantly you have an oasis. Maybe if you're the White House garden, you know, with, I'm sure she had plenty of help around. I mean, Charlie, it can be an oasis, but it can also, I mean, the weeds start coming and things get out of whack. It can, you know, where does it get tough first for Charlie, for people, Charlie?
Well, for beginning gardeners, I always steer them towards the small is beautiful line, thinking if you've never done this before, start small. Some containers on a back deck or patio, a small raised bed, that's the way to go. Because the best thing for a beginning gardener is to have some success. And even if you grew a few heads of lettuce or one tomato plant or a few zucchinis or something like that, but you had success. It was your plants and you were harvesting it and you could feed it to your family or your friends. You've got the green thumb and people are patting you on the back and you're feeling good about this gardening thing. Then the next year you put in a second raised bed or a third one and that's how it'll grow and you'll grow with the experience of it and you'll start really being more successful. The worst thing to do is to go out and till up the backyard and, you know, 600 square feet of garden and you're putting in all kinds of things you normally haven't grown before and the weeds get the better of you and things don't grow well.
You're my little potato. You're my little potato. They dug you up. You come from underground.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about garden fever this hour with hard times and the urge to make it really local, like your own backyard. Seems everybody suddenly wants to grow their own food. We're looking at what it takes to bring up the veggies. Charlie Nardozzi is with us from Colchester, Vermont. He's host of Vermont Garden Journal on Vermont Public Radio, author of Northeast Fruit and Vegetable Gardening. Karen Wolfgang is with us from Oregon, Portland, Oregon, owner and project coordinator at Independence Gardens. They help people build and grow edible gardens at home. Let's dive out right in with a lot of gardeners on the line here. Pam in Brentwood, Tennessee. Pam, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a recent gardener. I've come to it about, I guess, 3 years ago I started gardening.
Great.
Mainly I wanted some really delicious tomatoes. You can't seem to get them any time of the year.
That's pretty great bait. Yeah, they just don't taste so great in the store, but from home, how delicious.
They are. This year I have a bumper crop of volunteer squash. It came up from my compost heap, and I decided if they like it there, I'm going to leave them there. They're beautiful. They're the best-looking things in the garden.
So what kind of squash are we talking here? This is from seeds. You must have thrown some out, and so they just...
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm going to wait. It's exciting to see what it will be.
So how does that work? You've got your compost pile, and the vines are just stretching out from the pile, and you're going to let them go, Pam?
The compost in the garden. It's a raised bed garden, so I transfer it over there. So some of those seeds don't get killed off, I guess. I don't know how that works. But anyway, they're growing. They look beautiful. I figured if they like it there, I'll leave them there. I'm sort of a laissez-faire gardener. I let things be. I don't understand all the rules about gardening. I just stick it in and hope it grows. And so far, I've had a lot of success. And it makes me really happy. It's very satisfying.
Oh, that is great to hear. And we picture those beds right now. I appreciate your call, Pam. I mean, Karen, here's just throw the compost in, and pretty soon you got volunteer squash just showing up, and Pam's happy to have them. I guess some people are very regimented, put the string in straight line growth, and others kind of take it as it comes, even what comes out of the compost.
Yeah, the squash is a really good example of a surprise in the garden, because when it seeds itself, there's no real guarantee that the child squash will come true to the parent squash. So if you threw out a jack-o'-lantern pumpkin in your compost pile, you might get a very interesting squash come back the next year. The squash from a hybrid plant, you know, can express characteristics of either parent, and most of our squashes
are. You're kidding me. You mean
hybrids.
You put a pumpkin in there and you're going to come out with a zucchini?
Not a zucchini, but something that was bred to create that perfect round globe that you want to carve for, you know, for Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
But right. It's a lot of fun to watch those squash grow. And if you have the space and the time and the enthusiasm, which it sounds like this gardener definitely does, it's a fun project
to get
that surprise.
What about her laissez-faire gardening? Are you a straight line gardener, Karen, or are you a kind of get some good stuff going and let it roll?
My garden is a lot less straight-liney than most of the gardens that I create for clients. People are often surprised to see my garden. It's pretty wild. It has a lot of elements from the gardener that was there before me, who is a strictly ornamental gardener. And then I've brought in many perennial edibles as well as annual edibles. And right now I'm growing some food for our wedding, which is coming up in about a week.
Your very own wedding. Congratulations. What are you serving at your wedding from your garden?
Well, there's going to be a lot of beet greens and some carrots as well. And I have peas, which were a late arrival on the scene, although they did go in February. They're just now coming on.
Yeah.
I have quite a few things will stick in salads for this gathering.
Pretty great. Karen Wolfgang growing her own, even for her wedding. That's just terrific. Let's go to Mary in Merle's Inlet, South Carolina. Mary, thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. How are y'all?
Very well, Mary. What are you growing?
Well, actually, I do container gardening, and I was hoping just to get some good tips on what else I can grow. I've been growing lettuce, very satisfying, go out there and pick my little mescaline mix. I grow herbs, and just thought maybe Karen could tell us what else we could do successfully on just a very small patio.
Well, tell us, Mary.
Congratulations on our wedding.
Yeah, that is great, isn't
Thank
it?
Thank you.
Tell us about your container garden there. Is it, what direction does it face? Is it south facing? And how big are the pots? How many?
Well, actually, they're just very shallow, round pots. They're less than 17 inches in diameter. And I grow lettuce successfully in two of those. And I start herbs from seed in another one of about the same size. And I get enough salad just about every day and tons of herbs for everything that I need out of those three pots on a very small patio, probably not even facing the sun most of the time.
That's amazing. Three pots, and you've got a daily salad. Let's take it to Karen and to Charlie here. Karen, what about container gardening? Tips there for Mary?
I think you're doing exactly right. The right thing. The key to gardening is to be aware of, you know, the space available, which you clearly are, and your time, and then your desires. And if you want a salad every day, and the space that you have, and the time that you have makes that possible, I say, you know, stick with that for the time being. But if you wanted to expand, maybe integrate some flowers, some edible flowers, nasturtiums or calendula. Those can do well in shallow containers as well, as long as they're well watered. Container gardening tends to be a much different animal than in-ground gardening. And so you're playing with a different soil isn't, you know, container potting soil is not the same as soil in the ground. It doesn't have the same relationships between microorganisms. And so what you can do is a little more limited, but it sounds, again, like you've got it really dialed in for your situation. Sounds fantastic.
Charlie Nardozzi, what about it? Some edible flowers maybe. Mary's already got mescaline going there. With shallow pots, or if she goes deeper, what other options do you see for her on her patio, Charlie?
Well, if you have your pots there, you know, you really don't have to be very deep to grow a lot of different kinds of vegetables. If she has about a foot of soil in that pot, she could grow things like hot peppers, for example. I'm not sure if she likes hot food or not, but hot peppers are not only great plants to grow, they're very productive, especially in South Carolina with the warm heat down there, but they're also beautiful. There are some varieties that have dark purple or black-colored foliage, purple fruits that turn red. They're actually a very attractive plant to have in your landscape, and they do very well in containers. Now, if she also likes growing other kinds of salad vegetables, some of the dwarf cucumbers, salad bush, for example, is a variety that doesn't vine and grow all over the place like other cucumbers you might think of. It stays small, stays compact, would do well in a container. So I think she could start looking at some of those dwarf varieties that actually will fit in containers. If she had a bigger container, you can even grow some winter squash varieties like the Cornell Bush Delicata, which is a beautiful, small, little, single-serving squash that stays about the size of a small zucchini plant. So if you have a big enough container, you can grow an amazing array of things.
Mary, it sounds great there. Here's advice online coming in as well. RP writes, RP Twinkie, no less, I grow a garden on my apartment porch in pots. RP says we have squash, green beans, tomatoes, raspberries, cucumbers, basil, lettuce, and corn. Corn? No room for anything else. That sounds like a pretty full patio right there. Lorena in Arlington, Massachusetts is calling. Hi, Lorena. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Great. What's your story?
Yes, so I'm a new gardener. I just planted my garden last week, and I want to feed my baby out of my garden, and I was recently told that I needed to test my soil for nitrates. I want to know why and where can I get the soil tested?
Great question on nitrates there, and others, Charlie, are asking about lead if you're in an urban or suburban area. Mm-hmm. What about it? Lorena's got a baby, so she's especially attuned in. What should she look for, Charlie?
Well, especially if you're in an urban area, you should really take a look at certain heavy metals like lead, some of the petroleum products that might be a byproduct of what was in that soil before there was a house there. Those kinds of things can be tested for, and you can check with your state health department for tests on those, as well as local land-grant universities, University of Massachusetts in your case. You could probably do some specific tests that would tell you if any of those heavy metals are present, what the quantities of are those, and if they're a concern.
What about nitrates?
Well, nitrates would be a little bit different, and you can and get some tests for those as well. I think if you're adding compost regularly to your soil and your soil is pretty healthy, well-drained, you really shouldn't be too concerned about things like nitrates. Nitrates are really going to show up more. I think you have that concern more when you get into greenhouse production and you're getting more of a nitrogen buildup in the soil.
So how does it actually work? I mean, Charlie, do you go out and, you know, I don't know, put some soil in a little box and mail it away and they'll... How do you actually get it tested?
You'll get a kit, and you can get these at local garden centers or, like I said, at the extension services for the land-grant universities, and you take a sample of your soil. So, for example, if you have a raised bed, you would dig maybe 6 or 7 different holes in that raised bed, go down about 6 inches, put those all in a bucket, and then mix them all up, and then take a sample of your sample. Put that in the little kit that they have. Then you fill out the form explaining what you're growing, what you're looking for, what you're testing for, and send it away to a lab, and then they will send you the results back.
There's the way, Lorena, to a happy, healthy baby with veggies right out of mama's garden. Laura writes us here on Facebook about what she's growing. Tomatoes, 5 kinds, basil, peppers, habanero, and sweet cucumbers, dried beans, green beans, gourds, pumpkins, okra, onions, and strawberries. Most heirloom varieties. You can see people get into it and just go wild. And good eating, too. Deborah in Stowell, Massachusetts. Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
Well, gardening really redirected my whole life because I'd been a gardener and always thought I had to have a single-family house with a backyard and also put up with a lot of shade issues. Last summer, I took a 1,500-square-foot community garden, mm-hmm. and after the summer ended, by the fall, I had made the decision to sell my house and go landless, and I moved yesterday to the condominium of my dreams. I doubled my community garden, and I get 10 hours of sun on 3,000 square feet of land, and it's great. So you don't have to have land to garden.
So you're landless, but not really, because you've got a big footprint in a community garden there. It sounds like you can pull a lot of good eating out of there, Deborah.
Well, not only that, but when you have that much land, I have an actual patio, a 12 by 12 foot tarp with chairs, and I have a compost pile in my garden, and my dog can run loose up there. There's no cars, and I've met a ton of great people in the new town that I just moved to yesterday.
Wow, congratulations. It sounds like you've got a good situation put together there. Let us look at community gardens. And Karen, not everybody's got that big backyard, sun-filled patch. Here goes Deborah. You know, she leaves it behind, but she's hardly cut off from gardening with her community garden. How available is that for people? And does it depend where you are around the country? Are community gardens most everywhere now? Are there waiting lists to get in?
Mm-hmm. Here in Portland, our Portland Community Gardens run by the city are fantastic. It's a great program, but we do have waiting lists in several of the gardens. So a lot of people are turning to yard sharing as an alternative to that. So, you know people, and a lot of people have yard space that they're not using and would be willing to, you know, to trade with somebody else. Maybe some of the harvest from that area in exchange for it being farmed for them. And so that is cropping up as a barter opportunity as well as business opportunity for some of our colleague businesses here in Portland.
How does yard sharing work? What's yard sharing? How's that work, Karen?
So, say I live in an apartment and my, you know, cousin has a single family home but has a very, you know, a job with long hours and so doesn't really do much yard work, doesn't have the time and energy for gardening. But he's got the space and so maybe he invites me in and I come, you know, as regularly as I can, given my schedule, and grow food. And so some of that food goes to me or my purposes, maybe even to the food bank, and some of it goes back to my cousin in exchange for farming that land.
So just simple as that, and people take a lot away from it. Matt writes to us here, gardening is great for the temperament. I guess he means mood. You know, come what may. He says, raining, at least I don't have to water the garden. Hot and humid, at least the tomatoes and basil are enjoying the weather.
Mm-hmm.
But here's another, Charlie, a gardener bear writes to us, my potted basil always dies by July. What am I doing wrong? Help. What do you say, Charlie?
Well, basil is susceptible to certain diseases. So it, without knowing the weather conditions and what else is going on, it's probably hard to say what exactly is killing it. But there are some wilt diseases that will attack basil, especially under humid, warm conditions. And there are some varieties of basil that are resistant to that. So that would be one of the things, is to try a couple different varieties of basil. Another possibility would be to space them a little further apart so there's better airflow between the plants. The plants will dry out more quickly. And so when they're not wet, especially going into the evening, they're going to be less likely to get some of these foliar diseases and less likely, if the soil is drying out well, to get some of those root rot diseases.
Here's a listener goes with the handle No Television, maybe, but we're radio. Says, I'm harvesting over a pound of strawberries per day on a 10-year-old patch. There's nothing like it. Any perfect day includes a garden. Charlie, what about in your neck of the woods? Community gardens, sort of a yard sharing, is that robust?
Yes, it is. You know, I think Oregon and Vermont kind of have a symbiosis going on. There's very similar cultures here. The community gardens is also run by one here locally, by the city of Burlington, by the Parks and Recreation Department. There's always a waiting list for people to get on there. There is yard sharing and crop mobs and lots of CSAs going on, community-supported agriculture operations, which are really diversifying now. It used to be a very traditional relationship where you bought a share, you'd go pick up your vegetables, and that was it. Now you can do different kinds of shares. You can do volunteering on the farm. And so if you don't have the ability to get a community garden or you don't have the space to garden where you're living, you can still have the experience of being out in nature, growing your own food by being part of a CSA where you can work on the farm to work off some of the share money that you're getting the vegetables for.
I want to come back and talk about the economics of this. We've got a listener here saying the pitfall a lot of people fall into with gardening is the $64 tomato scenario. That is, you know, it says listening to businesses that want to sell them endless stuff for gardening instead of just straight up gardening. We are deep in the garden right now with the Beach Boys and their vegetables. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Your favorite vegetable. I know that you feel better when you send us in your letter and tell us the
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're having fun this hour talking about garden fever. With hard times and the urge to make it really local, like your own backyard, everybody seems to want to grow their own food all of a sudden. We're looking at what it takes to bring up the veggies. Karen Wolfgang is with us from Portland, Oregon, owner and project coordinator at Independence Gardens. They help people build and grow edible gardens at home. She's got her own 40 by 20 foot garden in her backyard, tomatoes, peas, squash, and more. Charlie Nardozzi is with us from Colchester, Vermont. He's a host of Vermont Garden Journal, a weekly program on Vermont Public Radio, author of Northeast Fruit and Vegetable Gardening. Lorna writes to us online, you don't need a lot of space. The strip running up my driveway has basil, sage, rosemary, lovage, marjoram, chives, garlic, tomatoes, and flowers, and that's just along the driveway. Sharon in Belmont, Massachusetts. Sharon, you're on the air.
Thanks for talking with me, Tom.
Sure.
I'm interested in making one point and asking your guests a question. I get a lot of pleasure out of my garden. I have a little small garden here in Belmont that turns out a quart of strawberries a day and herbs for my cooking, and I have a little greenhouse there where I can start things for a bigger garden that I have at my summer home. And I wanted to know what your guests thought was an optimal size for two people to manage. And by that I mean I love tomatoes and I love to can them for the winter, but how much should one person take on in terms of not wasting the crop at the end?
And is it one person working the garden or two? Is it one person working and two eating?
Husband.
Okay. And so you've got space, and I don't know, Charlie, that must be quite a variable equation to figure out the ideal size, mm-hmm. but you get a general sense there, Charlie. What do you say? You know, how many, if you're going to lay one out, how many square feet?
Well, if it's for eating for two people, but one person's taking care of it, you know, a simple garden that's maybe 10 by 20 might be plenty for that situation. If you wanted to go larger, there's a lot of techniques and tips that you can use that makes a large garden much easier to maintain. Things like mulching the pathways, using raised beds, you know, stuff of that nature will reduce the amount of weeding you have to do, the mm-hmm. amount of watering you have to do. And when you're using raised beds in particular, you can concentrate fertilizing and harvesting and doing what we call succession planting, meaning you plant one crop after another. In that same bed so that you can take a garden that may only be 10 by 20 and produce a ton of food from it.
Now, if you go 10 by 20, do you have sprawling vines in a garden that size, or is that all stuff that's pretty tidy and, you know, not a giant radius, Charlie?
Well, you could have some vines for sure, and you can trellis some of the vines upward too. So, for example, you can use pole beans mm-hmm. and create a pole bean teepee. So instead of using bush beans that may take more horizontal space, you can grow things more vertically that way. Mm-hmm. You can grow cucumbers up a trellis and doing a similar kind of thing. It kind of depends upon your situation. If you have your 10 by 20 square foot garden in your lawn and you're okay with it kind of bleeding into the lawn a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
You certainly can grow your pumpkins and your winter squashes and things on the edge, which I've done a number of times, and mm-hmm. melons, mm-hmm. and just let them go out into the lawn. Let them just kind of take over some of the lawn areas. You won't be able to have that completely manicured look on the lawn anymore where those vines are going, but you're kind of incorporating a lot of space that normally would just be grass.
Karen, what do you think about 10 by 20? And speak to us also about cost, because a lot of people come to this, especially these days, to bring in some nice crops of affordable food. But, you know, if you don't play it right, it's not necessarily affordable. You can spend a lot getting it in.
Sure. And a lot of the cost is, you know, upfront cost. So if you're going to do infrastructure improvements, for instance, wooden-sided raised beds, you need to pay for those right up front. And mm-hmm. then you need to bring in some soil to fill those beds, most likely. So a lot of that does. Yeah, get expensive really fast. But you can do many of the gardening techniques that are best practices with very little investment, depending on the resources you have available. So if you're in a more rural community and have somebody in the neighborhood doing wheat, for example, and they have extra straw, then you could use that for mulching your paths easily. You don't have to go to the local, you know, mulch place and buy yourself some mulch. So there's ways to use inputs that are free or very low cost to keep your costs down. Also, starting your own seeds can help keep costs down quite a bit versus buying from starts at the nursery. Using raised beds without wooden sides, so just bermed up soil, can be a lot less cost than the wooden sided raised beds.
We've got,
for example, cinder blocks for free, you know, on somebody's corner, Craigslist.
Okay, it may not be your rustic idol, but you can
That's
do
right.
it. Barbara
you
writes
can do
to,
it.
Writes to us here. Listener Barbara says, "Don't fall into the Home Depot trap of buy, buy, buy. Mm-hmm. Start from seed. Use newspaper and chopped up leaves from mulch. Compost all year. Home gardens should save you money, not leave you spending more." Joseph in Columbia, South Carolina. Thanks for calling, Joseph. You're on the air.
How you doing, Tom? Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you. What's in your garden?
We actually have corn, strawberries, squash, cucumbers, watermelon, and butter bean. And we have that all crammed into a little 6x4 garden raised bed.
Wow.
That's great.
Good for you.
Boy, the way you say butter bean makes me hungry right off the bat, Joseph.
We're waiting on them to show up, that's for sure.
So how long do you think until you'll have your first veggies on the kitchen table from this year's garden?
Well, the squash and the cucumbers have really started coming on really fast here lately. Almost everything else has vegetables or fruit on it. We're just waiting for the size and the ripeness of it.
Sure.
You know, we're talking about the vines, the watermelons and stuff like that stretching out into the yard. That's kind of the way we planned it. We've got everything planted on the outside edge that will reach out into the yard, and mm-hmm. we'll just basically paper plate them out there once they get far enough out there to grow some big fruit on.
Hey, and Joseph, how did you learn gardening? Was it like at your, I don't know, mom and dad's elbow when you were a kid, or did you get into it when you got an adult yourself, or what?
Being from South Carolina, I actually come from a long line of farmers. Mm-hmm. Never did a whole lot myself, but as my children came along, the interest in getting them back into it was the biggest thing. The first year we started with just actually buying plants. This year is our first year at actually having the kids seed start trays and actually just plant seed straight into the garden, which have been actually the most successful. The transplanting was always a little bit of if to it, but the actually just starting seed straight off in the garden seems to be the most effective for us.
Joseph, it sounds great. I see a steaming bowl of butter beans in your future, and I wish I was there to share it with you, but thank you so much for your call. One more right here. John in Arlington, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You should really be my soon-to-be 22-year-old son making this call, but you know what? He's too busy designing and building edible organic vegetable gardens for people, doing the heavy labor.
Great. Where is he doing it? Around here or somewhere else?
All in the Boston West area. But this is a kid who, right out of high school, on his bike with a trailer, would go and do the heavy work for folks, have compost deliver. 4 years later, after studying and mentoring under permaculture of organic farmers in California, in Hawaii, New Zealand, Australia, studying permaculture, which you guys might want to talk about, and woofing. Mm. He's, this is a model of a terrific vocational opportunity for young people. He's doing incredibly well. He's got testimonials like you wouldn't believe, and unbelievably productive small gardens that people are thrilled to have. He's interested in blueberry bushes and rooftop gardens.
John, that sounds great. And, I just all the time running across young people very interested in that kind of career path. But I heard you use a word that I've heard recently myself and I hadn't heard before, woofing. What is woofing, John?
It's a worldwide network. I think of it as Worldwide Organization of Organic Farms. That is not the right name. For some reason, I can't give you the real name.
Okay. What is it?
The idea is that free room and board, all around the world, there's a network of organic farmers who post their farms. You get free room and board. You work a minimum of 4 hours a day, and there you are. And you're studying, you're mentoring under experienced farmers. And my son, again, did it in Northern California, Hawaii, Australia, New Zealand.
Wow.
Australia is where the whole field of permaculture was born.
Woofing, W-O-O-F, and what, you make the contact online or something pretty soon, seeing the world organic farming.
There's a domestic woof program. There's an international woof program. You join for very small dollars. You get the catalog, and literally you go from one farm to the next, and it's been wonderfully instructive and successful for him. And as you said, he's now going into a real direction and an existing business that he's doing fabulously well. He just hired his first full-time person. He's got a dump truck, having a ball, and the kid's turning 22.
That is a great story, John. I'm so glad you share it. I can hear thousands of young people clacking online right now, looking up their first woofing engagement in Hawaii or California or New Zealand. Thank you so much for that. Good luck to your son. Charlie, permaculture, what are we talking about here?
Well, permaculture, as he was mentioning, started down in Australia, New Zealand, and it's a way to really maximize when you're growing edibles or growing any crops in your yard, to do it in what we call a closed system, meaning that the energy that goes in is being produced on that piece of land. So you're using a lot of different kinds of techniques, organic gardening techniques. You're using trees, you're using shrubs, you're using edible landscaping techniques, meaning that the trees and shrubs and plants that you're choosing are not just going to be ornamentals, but they're going to be there to produce food for you, for wildlife, for a bunch of the natural systems. So you're supporting the natural ecosystem that's around you, and you're also, and at the same time, producing food for yourself and for your community.
Wow, that sounds pretty great as well. What a bunch of great callers and people writing in online. Talk about young. Here's Grace writing to us, I'm 13, and I've had a garden since I was 6. This year I've got potatoes, tomatoes, peppers, leeks, lettuce, carrots, beets, cucumbers, cantaloupe, pumpkins, and zinnias, something to bring in on the kitchen table. We harvested lettuce from my garden last week and had it for dinner. I find it really satisfying and fun. I bet she does. Susan in Hermitage, Tennessee. Susan, thank you for calling. Hermitage, that's got a ring to it, Susan.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, my gardening has changed over the years. I've been gardening for well over 30 years. And this year, I've added chickens to the...
Added chickens? How do you plant those? What do you mean?
Well, I have a 30 by 30 garden, and I decided to give half of it to the chickens, building a really nice coop inside the fenced garden. And I let the chickens in and out and constantly work to figure out ways to keep them from eating the plants that I'm growing in. So far, I've been pretty successful.
Now, what's the advantage there? Don't they peck up your seeds, or is it that they fertilize your garden while they poke around? How's it work?
Yeah, they're fertilizing for sure, and they are eating the weed seeds, and they're just pleasurable animals to have, and it's actually made me more interested in my garden. But I do have to create little paddocks and practice a lot of ingenuity to keep them away from certain vegetables.
Right.
They may completely ignore things for a few days and then go after something. So I've gotten this inexpensive, lightweight plastic fencing from one of the big box stores, and I just kind of make surrounds where there's an issue, and they'll go on and look for something else.
Wow.
And then I usher them back into their enclosed cook for the evening,
Susan the chicken usher. it's a great story and a great vision, Susan. There in Hermitage, Tennessee, I think Andrew Jackson's hometown. Karen, what about it? Get a little feathered livestock in there in the garden too.
Yeah, absolutely. Chicken poop is a fantastic garden fertilizer, and it does need to be composted before it's used. It's too hot to use fresh, too nitrogen rich. But composting that, generally what is done is running the chickens 1 year on one half of the garden space and fully enclosing them in that space. And then at the end of the season for the garden, turning the chickens over to that other side and letting them work the detritus, the end result of the garden, back into the ground through their poop. And then that other half that they were in the year before becomes the garden for the next year. So you're basically recycling nutrients. And they do a lot of the heavy lifting for us. They're very good at destroying plants.
Turning them back
into an amendment.
Right.
Yes.
Right. An amendment, no less. That's a great phrase. Never heard that one before. Someone called you an amendment. It's got a whole new meaning. Charlie Bob, up your way in Vermont, says, what about organic versus chemical fertilizers? What do you say, Charlie?
Well, I've been an organic gardener my whole life, so it's just kind of a personal decision to make. But there are a lot of very practical reasons for doing organics versus just using whatever you'd find in a local box store or local garden center. And organic gardening is more than just substitutes of taking one fertilizer for another fertilizer. It's a whole different kind of attitude. It's really building the soil. It's feeding the soil versus feeding the plants. It's using different kinds of additives that are going to create a healthy soil environment so that the plants are going to grow stronger. And stronger plants are just like with people. If you're healthy, you're going to have less diseases and problems with your body. Same thing happens with plants. If the plants are growing on strong, fertile soil, they're going to have less insect attacks, less diseases, less nutritional problems. They're just going to grow much better. And the organic movement has really expanded over the last 20 years. And so you're seeing organic fertilizers, organic pesticides out there that makes it so much easier to be an organic gardener. And frankly, I really don't see why anyone would not be doing it, because it's much better for the environment, better for you, because these are safer products to use on your plants. And when you're eating those, you don't have to be worried about what kind of chemicals you're putting into your body or into your family's bodies.
Well, take it from the master right there. Charlie, we're out of time here, I'm afraid, but it's been so great having you. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed it, and so great to hear from all the gardeners out there getting close to earth and soil and sun and water and seeds. Charlie Nardozzi with Vermont Garden Journal on Vermont Public Radio, author of Northeast Fruit and Vegetable Gardening. Charlie, thank you for your time today.
It's been great being here.
Karen Wolfgang in Portland, Oregon at Independence Gardens. Thank you so much for joining us today, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me.
And one special note today, we love taking On Point on the road, getting out of the studio once in a while, East Coast, West Coast, everywhere in between. We call it On Point Live, a great show taped before a live audience with some good fun on the side. Our next On Point Live happens to be right here in Boston, June 14th at the fabulous Paramount Center. Big-time environmental thinker and activist Bill McKibben will be our special guest. Musical guest, the great Martin Sexton. Jack Beatty will be in the house. We'll have the thrills and spills of live radio and a chance to mix and mingle with you. If you're in Boston, come along for the show and the fun. We'd love to see you. June 14th. All the details at onpointradio.com. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy. That's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy. And that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.